These were the souls of the stones, souls which the priests had a magical power to command. Also I saw the sylphs fleeting through the darkness of the summer night. Beloved, not long ago I felt fresh and unwearied, but now a heaviness comes upon me. I had meant to write of the coming of the devas, of the mighty sun angels which came to make ready for the coming of the sun, and of the sun's descent to earth. Let me rest before I complete this account. 2. Beloved, when I woke a moment ago you were closely with me. I think that my spirit has flown across the land and ceased to be with you, if only for a moment, and I am sure we two are interwoven, because what I have seen during the hour of darkness and dawn, has set my spirit free from its mortal chains, for these hours at least. Do you see the prints of an animal's feet on this letter? A hare came close to me while I slept, a beast usually so timid, but now it stands not 20 feet away completely unafraid. A map of Stonehenge. I saw a dog walk close to it, yet neither seemed interested in the other. So it is with us all. Peace reigns. The fears of one beast for another and their fear of man are alike stilled. Folk who have attended this ceremony before, tell me that neither man nor beast will feel hunger again for several days, so richly has their being been filled by the sun. This I shall soon know. Certainly I feel no hunger so far. As I lie here and write, the sweet savor of the earth is all around me. It comes not only from the soil itself, with all its myriad sweet herbs, nor even is it the scent of earth brought out by the sun, as we normally know it. A heavenly essence has endowed the earth, a fragrance sculled from the high clouds and the distant blue heavens golden with sunshine, an essence compounded of all blessedness and holiness brought by the dawn. Let me return to my story. I have told you about the trackway of the sun reaching out from Stonehenge direct to where the sun would rise, and of how we went out to the end of that trackway, and there breathed in the power and light of the yet unrisen sun, and of how we then paced in procession back towards Stonehenge, all chanting and singing through the night, thereby breathing out that sunlight and power, and of how because of this, the trackway itself became glowing with ethereal light, so that we walked through pools of light. We only saw these things revealed because we ourselves had become raised in consciousness. All would have remained hidden and ourselves blind to these wonders, had we been our normal selves, I believe, for in his daily self man is imprisoned in ignorance and stupidity. But it was not so at this hour of wonder. For as we walked I saw men transfigured. Yes. Both men and women walked as gods, freed from their clay, with shining eyes and kingly bearing, from their enkindled inner selves a light shone forth, so that we saw that God dwelt in man, and that man dwelt and walked with God in those hours before the dawn. They are so glorious to remember that I do not think that I shall ever again think meanly of my fellow creatures, having seen them thus ennobled. I have told you how the wild animals stole out from copse and woodland, to share with man this blessing of the sun, and of how unafraid they were, and of how the little people of the fairylands were revealed by the blue light which shone from the circle of blue stones brought all the way from the fairy-ridden hills of Wales to Stonehenge. Now to tell you of the Devic lords which rule over these orders of nature, for all kingdoms of nature have their controllers and all life exists under direction. There is a great stone near the temple, upon which the Devic lords gather. It stands immediately outside the outer stone circle and in the trackway of the sun, but not directly at its center. All of us had been solemnly warned not to look directly upon that stone or its occupants. So we walked past with downcast eyes. Yet I dared to glance out of the corner of my eye occasionally. How could one not do so? I saw figures standing there, sometimes several, sometimes only one giant form. Some were beautiful, some fearful to look upon, some were winged beings, some were horned with pointed ears, some had cloven feet. But I saw no more than that. But now the night was giving way to dawn, although the sun's rim did not yet show over the edge of the earth. Now the trackway of the sun glowed breast high, shoulder high, head high, with its own light. We waded through light, we breathed it in. It irradiated us. Stonehenge itself became a great temple of light, a temple roofed with light. Now we saw all things clearly. It seemed to me that I saw God and man revealed, and God's purpose with man made clear, but no words of mine can ever clothe this vision of the heart and soul. Now we saw the white-clad priests gather round the closed end of the inner temple. Three stood on the rose-colored altar stone itself. Before that stone, 20 feet away, untouched by anyone throughout the whole ceremony, was a heap of brushwood as high as a man, with sticks as thick as a man's finger, and butts as thick as his wrist or forearm, and all very dry. All this while I watched for the coming of the angels which herald the dawn. They came very quietly, very gently taking shape. At first I saw four dim forms outlined against the graying sky, yet mighty forms for all that. They stood on the outer rim of trilithons, one at the north, one at the west, one at the south, one against the glowing sky to the east, as high as the stones themselves. They stood immobile and with wings folded, and the sight was hailed with a gasp of wonder from the people, while over the rim of the world the edge of the sun appeared in an unclouded sky. At this supreme moment we saw the light sweep up from the sun, wave upon wave, light irradiating light across a sky glowing with gold and rose, across the wide earth. Now we saw the angelic forms more clearly as they took shape against the sky and the people began to break ranks. Unbidden, they clustered around the trilithons at the closed end of the horseshoe, behind and at the very sides of the altar stone. I stood away to the east between the sun and the temple so that I could see the angels. Not 50 yards away I saw the angel of the east begin to glow. Those of the west, the north, the south retained something of the silver grey of the night from which they had come forth. But the angel of the east waxed mightier than they. They were spirits of the earth, he of the sun, and as I watched, I saw him becoming clothed and glowing with the sun. By now the lower edge of the sun was just over the horizon, and then I saw the angel extend his wings until they seemed to enwrap the golden heavens. I saw his form glow ever brighter so that I shaded my eyes and bowed my head, and then. No one touched that heap of brushwood, no one went near it. I saw the priests on the altar stone extend their arms in invocation, and that moment a pillar of white flame rose straight into the air, entirely smokeless, soundless as a prayer. It soared straight up, burnt silently and splendidly for a space, then sank into the earth. Yes, literally, it sank into the earth. I visited the spot afterwards, there were no ashes, no burning of the grass. It was a miracle. I stood there weeping like a child. All around me, men and women wept or clung together. Some lay down to kiss the earth which had become so blessed. None of us doubted that the Lord of the Sun had come down to earth to kindle that soaring flame, which had presently sunk into the earth to bless and to enkindle her. We knew, as did all the birds and beasts of the earth, that we had been greatly endowed. They knew, those women who were with child or who would conceive this year, that they were blessed and their unborn children were blessed. We knew that our harvests would be rich and plentiful. Our hearts overflowed with thankfulness, with tears of thankfulness we blessed the earth. And as we went about and walked in the blessed daylight of that blessed day, strangers went up to each other, grasped hands, embraced or kissed, because love was so quick and powerful in their hearts. This story of Stonehenge, though of a different age and people, calls to mind certain passages in Grace Cook's The Illumined Ones, in which she describes her life with a brotherhood of a very ancient order in South America. The book tells of what happened when the Mayan girl, Minesta, climbed, together with her brother in the sage Hawata, her father, to the crest of a mountain in the Andes, and how they had found hidden amid the pine trees a white temple where a mystic brotherhood lived, and how they were permitted to witness and share in the work of the inner brotherhood, how they had later stood before the altar in the inner shrine, and joined with the brotherhood in sending out the light, which was in essence their own united soul power poured forth in a supreme effort of self-giving and saw it directed to many communities, and also to individual men and women living in other parts of the world. It would appear that the brothers of those ancient days in South America were not so far removed in spirit from our hillmen of Britain. Etheric vision reveals that the worship of both peoples was a form of self-giving, a literal pouring out of self, and sometimes with almost a passion of self-surrender, for the benefit of others or for the blessing of their crops. The rogation, the special blessing of their crops, was crucial to these people. They were familiar with the little people of the etheric world, who tended those crops, and on these, abundance depended. Insect life, bird life, animal life, all three played their part in this sowing and growing. But more essential than all was the blessing of etheric life. For everything growing has an etheric body as well as its physical self, and that etheric self also needs nourishment. The little people were those appointed to watch over the crops. On their continuing goodwill and friendship, much depended. Almost every primitive race throughout the world seems to have accepted this truth, judging by the worldwide myths which affirmed the reality of the little people. They had not wholly come down to earth, these ancient brothers. Their vision was as clear as ours is dulled. They saw the little people and the angels, whereas we can see nothing. The substance of their bodies had not become heavy like ours. We have descended since their day, come down and down, until we are imprisoned by the very weight of ourselves. We are still human souls, but boxed in and cumbrous is our raiment, and while we just have to believe ourselves modern and knowledgeable, dimly we glimpse that life might be far richer were we not barred out from Eden and become wanderers in that wilderness which is our world. 8. When the serpent rose heavenward, the mystical teaching long ago established in this country is linked with the legendary King Arthur and the Brotherhood of the Knights of the Round Table. To each knight is allotted two places at the table, one light and the other dark, so each knight is represented as a dual being, one light and the other dark, but there is nevertheless a perfect balance and perfect equilibrium of the whole. This symbolism teaches that every soul must strive until these two aspects are perfectly balanced. All in the end have to find perfect balance, equilibrium and understanding of the value of both the positive and negative aspects of life, must blend the two, seeing in each the wisdom of God's law and the purpose and ultimate perfection of all creation. We now leave the chalk downs for a while, and look back to the year 1947, when we travel to the city of St. David's in Pembrokeshire. Northwest of St. David's and beyond the wide stretch of white to Sands Bay, the great rocky bastion of St. David's Head, faces the sea at the most westerly point of Wales. The coast about St. David's Head is ruggedly grand, providing some rough and hazardous cliff walking. Behind it lies a wild area, scattered with stones large and small, and marked in the guidebook as ancient enclosures. There is nothing much to sketch or photograph, only a rubbly plain, with rubbly hills behind, and beyond the high rocky coast, a shining sea. Dolmens, hut circles and the like are plentiful, all left by ancient man as reminders of his life here. It was this area, these ancient enclosures and in particular the remarkable serpent circle, to the northeast of the highest hill, Carnlidai, which most interested my wife, who said on arrival that she saw this barren countryside as having formerly been warm and gracious, soft and gentle and full of growth and plenty. What had happened to it since, she did not know, but perhaps some convulsion of nature, a rush of flood waters or storming rains had washed the surface soil away, leaving only rocky subsoil behind. Picture then, our little group amid the wild stones of St. David's Head, listening as the vision of the past began to unfold. St. David's Head, I see what I take to be a druid. He has white hair and rosy cheeks, a big, strong, kindly father figure. He has a staff, and on it a sign, the emblems of the zodiac are on his sash. He is holding court, blessing the people. I see also one who is as a queen, a beautiful, motherly woman, big in stature, of a race taller than people of today. The link with the Andes and Willem is very strong. The people are olive-skinned, darker than now. This is a fertile land with beautiful things growing in it. The people from the neighborhood and all over the country used to come to it. The people bring gifts of things that they have made to the central court. They are very clever with their hands, and make most beautiful things, and with most lovely colors not obtainable today. Where are all these things gone? I can see that the court or inside of the palace is made of gold, with lovely figures and pictures. The great feature is happiness, the feast, the joy, the dancing, the flowers. I feel that we could talk to the birds and animals in the same way that we do to human beings, for we all understand the same language. The trees and flowers were kindred to us, and even the grass would offer its gift. All forms of life offered their gifts. There was a battle between good and evil leaders, and the good withdrew, but are waiting to take over and teach the children, their descendants, how to regain the kingdom. The children follow their own way, they wander in the wilderness for a period until the rebirth of a new age. What happens to individuals happens also to whole races and even to worlds. All life moves in cycles. These were descendants of the ancient people who came from Hyakbora, the original people of this earth planet. The pure sun life has gone back into the earth, into the great caves. In those days the sacred magical fire was kept burning from one solstice to the other, brought down from on high. It never went out. It was life to the people. I can now see great basings round and round and round, and on and on. Beautiful was the feeling as we based the serpent trail, the wisdom trail. This perambulation had an effect on our whole being physically, mentally, etherically and spiritually. People used to make pilgrimages here from Egypt, from the east, from the west. The Egyptians came here for the wisdom and took it back to their sun-baked land. What remains here, the stones that you see overthrown, are meaningless to the blind, but contain the eternal wisdom to those whose eyes are opened. These stones are older than any of the Egyptian temples, yes, older than the Great Pyramid itself. This spot is more ancient than Stonehenge. Stonehenge is a later erection after the flood. These centers can be found across Britain from south to north in the form of a vast cross. But the line is more to the west than the east. The following is another account written down afterwards by Grace Cook, from notes taken on a different occasion at St. David's Head in July 1947. My inner vision opened and I saw the ceremony of serpent worship taking place. I saw the great numbers of people by their perambulation in a large circle right round the valley. The sight lay in a kind of flat valley, were creating circles of light, on the etheric plane just above them. As the perambulation proceeded, the spiritual power rose and increased. From the center of the circle made by the human figures, a line of light arose which moved in a spiral, keeping pace with, or rather, quickening the human figures as they perambulated. Then as I watched, the spiral of light thus generated, began to rise from the valley high up to the heavens, increasing in size and radiance as it rose. And at the top of the spiral, which now resembled a rising serpent, there formed a blazing light in shape like a sun, full of color, and sending forth rays which now extended over and blessed the adjacent lands, that is, as far as my vision of the lands went. This explained to me the true inner working and purpose which had inspired and was behind the serpent worship. I was told that later this ceremony had become corrupt in some lands, taking form as a kind of black magic, so that participants only succeeded in arousing the sexual fire of Kundalini in man. It was this debasing of the power which brought eventual destruction to various civilizations, which in the beginning had been instructed by God men, how to use the power of the white light. One still senses the grey remnants left on the etheric plane by such rituals. In the new age, man's intellectual pride and arrogance must be eradicated if mankind is to regain contact with the true spiritual life forces. It is the grey mental world which is the real enemy of mankind. Nevertheless, my teachers said that it would be incorrect for us to interpret the fall or descent of the human race as contrary to the divine plan, for only through experiencing or undergoing the lessons of life, both good and bad while on earth, can man or woman attain to the perfect balance, which must be held between human and divine life, as was exemplified by Jesus. This sacred white light was once understood as being the very life force of our race. A time must come when this spiritual creative force will be better understood by our people, for it is their veritable life essence. Street Nun's Well, to the inner eye, the neighborhood of St. David's is bespangled with points of light shining like stars in the night sky. At each of these centers I saw ancient spirits, both human and of the elemental type. Due south of St. David's lies the little sheltered cove of Street Nun, and in a field above can be found the ruins of Street Nun's Chapel, which marks the spot where St. David is said to have been born. When I was meditating by Street Nun's Well, I became aware of the presence of a beautiful woman, who seemed the very personification of perfect motherhood. To look upon the brightness of her face and raiment was like trying to look straight into the sun. It was far too bright for me to gaze upon, but I still remained aware of her presence and of the marvelous holy power she radiated. Then two further figures appeared. My impression was that one of them was Saint Michael with the flaming sword of truth unsheathed, and that the other was Saint John, bearing the scroll of the new church, to which will presently be entrusted the secret of creation and the true story of the Garden of Eden. I learnt in my vision that in the beginning, when human life first came, the earth was created in perfect balance. I was told that life started in the Hyperborean regions of the earth, and that what is now Great Britain was part of the first home of humanity. In those days it was like a garden of paradise. The land was fertile, the sun above warm and life-giving, there were many kinds of fruits, and rich grasslands on which kindly animals fed. These were never exploited in order to satisfy the greed of man, because in those days there was no greed. This was a land flowing with milk and honey, and so it continued for a while, until the testing by the forces of evil came, and many succumbed, tempted by lust for power. Thus there were two groups: on the one hand those who under Lucifer left the paradise, which had been theirs, and descended into a wilderness of coarser bodies and lives of hard work and struggle spent in matter, and on the other, the still gentle and kindly white brethren who lived under the direction of their Lord the Sun King. The messenger repeated that Britain was the first home of these ancient white brothers. Although most of them are now withdrawn from sight, they still dwell in the hills and in lonely places removed from the conflict of earth. They know that Britain can rise again with their help. So the white brothers linger on, patiently watching and waiting for men to turn away from false gods, towards the pure light of the gentle ones. Arthur's Colt. At sunset one day, while near Arthur's Coat, a great cromlech close by St. David's Head, I seemed to see right through the earth and rocks and beheld an assembly of the white brethren, wise men of noble countenance, counseling with each other about the future of mankind. The brethren then conveyed to me that they belonged to a race preceding the advent of our present humanity. They had witnessed the downfall of Atlantis, which, they said, was due to the overpowering mental development of the Atlantean priesthood, who had possessed highly developed occult power which they used for selfish ends. This misapplication of spiritual power caused the earth to attract to itself a body from outer space. May allude to the destroyer comet? R.O.M. plus appendix. This cataclysm struck the earth thousands upon thousands of years ago, and may well have inspired the story of the fall of man and the subsequent closing of the gates of Eden. Humanity became completely clothed in the densest matter, and has now reached the lowest point of the path it then took, the lowest depths in its imprisonment in heaviness and limitation. However, the brothers also spoke of a future of freedom, brighter far than man of today can ever glimpse. Centers of the ancient brotherhood have been established in many countries, but will remain unknown and invisible because they function in a higher dimension than humanity does. Nevertheless, they are as real as this world is, and the ancient ones can and will slow down the vibration of the ether in which they exist, until it merges into physical matter. This is how the ancient brethren will come among us again in the new age, ready to impart their secrets to those who can understand. The brothers also spoke about the method of transit employed on Atlantis, which was by levitation and projection across space, a method as natural to men in those days as walking is to us today. Communication between the various groups of brethren held no difficulty because a messenger could be sent from Britain to Atlantis, or to the Andes, or to the Himalayas in a matter of seconds. One method was for the initiate to retire into a chamber in the temple high on the mountains. There he would compose himself as if for sleep, and in a few seconds his bodily form would dissolve and vanish from sight, and immediately afterwards would appear among the particular brotherhood to which he had been sent. The brothers assured me that this means of communication would be used again, and that when mankind was more advanced spiritually, it would be able to enter into communication with other planets in this way. Phil-Eri, another place of magic lies in the Presley Hills. Resting on a large flat stone on the summit of Phil-Eri, one of the highest of this range, I was almost in another world, and in that higher state of consciousness, I was again visited by an ancient one, who looked ageless and stood half as high again as present-day man. He wore a long white flowing beard, and his deep violet eyes were shining with compassion. Also they held a humorous twinkle and conveyed a wide understanding. Indeed, this man inspired a confidence and peace of spirit beyond words of mine to describe. His flowing white robe and golden crown suggested kingship, and were, I think, a symbol of his true authority. I questioned, could this be the spirit of Britain or some ancient king of Britain, perhaps Arthur, whose presence had remained here in this mystic isle to help his people to rise again from their dead past to inherit a new golden age. As I waited before this noble figure, I felt bathed again and again in golden light. I felt his warmth of blessing, and the mountainside faded entirely from my consciousness. Now the vision changed, and there seemed something strangely familiar about the figures I now saw gathered in a temple similar to a Grecian building, but not of the type with which we are familiar today. I noticed how the columns rose from the golden mosaic floor to support the very high dome translucent roof. Here again a ceremony of the white brethren was taking place, not unlike that which I had seen in the serpent circle at St. David's Head. I saw that the perambulating brothers were clothed in drapery fastened on each shoulder with a jeweled clasp, and underneath this I could see the outline of a tunic, such as the Greeks wore. The women wore flowing white robes girdled with gold, and the cross and under the breasts was a golden cord, and fastened to each shoulder was the flowing cloak. They wore long hair coiled at the nape of the neck, and the head was decorated with the familiar gold band. Could this have been a vision of a later age? The significance of the partnership between the men and women of the Brotherhood was now impressed on me. For in this perambulation the whole company became exactly and perfectly balanced, the male and female, the positive and negative life streams were mingled and made one, and again I saw the golden serpent of light arise from the assembled brethren, its head at length disappearing from sight beyond the opalescent dome of the temple. These visions at St. David's, which occur before those on the downland, are clear and powerful, and help to elucidate or underline much that has gone before. They speak of the perpetual battle between the good and evil powers, of the corruption of the pure white magic by desire for power and gratification of the lower self. They give a picture of the two paths, of humanity gradually degenerating because of the domination of the lower self, coming right down into matter, into coarse bodies of flesh, to experience sorrow and travail and eventually gain wisdom, and of those other pure white brothers, and particularly the mighty and beautiful Arthur, who remain just beyond the veil, in the white ether, waiting to help men rise and return to their father, but all the time pouring out their love and wisdom on mankind. We understand too, that all these happenings recounted, belong largely to what is referred to as an earlier humanity, before Atlantis was submerged in some great cataclysm brought about by men's misuse of the power entrusted to them. Through it we see the theme of the timeless brotherhood, who from age to age, from one race to another, have guided and sustained Earth's humanity. White Eagle says, "You will ask, if this beauty once existed on the Earth, why is it that it is now finished and that we are living, as you tell us, like savages?" because the priests who received their knowledge from the Great Sun Brotherhood found that they could use magical secrets to give them dominion over their fellows. Implanted in all of us are the two aspects of positive and negative, good and evil.